Hello, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of the Gamers Podcast, where we are focusing on some live conferences. I'm joined today by Eric Schweitzer.
Hello.
And Andrew King.
Hello.
Eric has spent the last week at GDC for us, and Andrew has been at PAX East. They're both quite different conferences. GDC is mainly developers going and talking to developers, doing different presentations on how their games were built. So a lot of the things that Eric's been seeing, you've already seen on the site. Things like Larian saying they're not going to make another Baldur's Gate. That came from GDC. Whereas at PAX, that's a lot more hands-on, a lot more games to see, a lot more developer interviews. So Eric's done some of that, but he'll mainly be focusing on the developer side of things. Whereas for Andrew, got a hands-on quite a few different games. Why don't you kick us off with that, Andrew?
Yes, so I did. I saw quite a few games at PAX East. If you don't know, PAX East is more public-facing, I would say, than GDC, so it's a pretty busy show floor. So, you know, you go in and then there's all these booths set up, probably, you know, hundreds of games split up between, you know, video games and physical games, and public can sort of wander from booth to booth and stand in lines for those, and I had appointments. I was in between those all week from Thursday to Sunday. So I can talk about some of the cool things I saw if you'd like.
Yeah, let's get some memories, the big standout, some of the, I know there's some new games out. Kind of had what revealed basically at PAX or shown off for the first time to press and public.
Yeah, I was excited to see Rugrats Adventures in Gameland.
I played that too.
Yeah, when that was announced last year, I was like, well, this is my most anticipated game for 2024, which was partially from, you know, Rugrats nostalgia and partially because 2023 was super busy and 2025 looks like it'll be busy. But this year at that time was not looking like it would be especially busy. So a Rugrats game could easily rise to the top. But what I played of it is pretty cool. The developer that I spoke to from Mix Games, I believe is the name of the developer, who is working with Limited Run on this. It began as a game they were making for NES. And so you can play all of the game in like an 8-bit style that looks, I don't know, maybe it might just be because Tommy's head is so round and hairless, but it reminded me a lot of Bonk. Looked a lot like the Bonk games. So you can play those in 2D, but then, like, you know, sort of like the Halo remasters that 343 did for Xbox a while ago, you can switch at any moment and play in HD, which just looks like exactly like you're playing the cartoon.
It's funny that they call it HD mode, because it's a completely different art style. It's not like they round off the edges or anything. It's just it goes from 8-bit video game to hand-drawn cartoon, but it's like,
right
now you're playing in HD.
Right, and it's kind of jarring too, because the original is like, you know, boxy, square, like you're playing it on a CRT. And then when you switch, and there is like a CRT mode, so you can have like the scan lines and stuff. And then when you switch to the new one, it's fully widescreen. So it just looks like, you know, two completely different eras of video games. But the developer I spoke to said the code underneath is exactly the same, because they built the old looking version completely originally, and then decided just to add this, you know, hand-drawn looking version. So it's the same code base underneath, but completely different visuals and like completely different presentation, even in terms of like aspect ratio.
That was cool. When we did the Tomb Raider collection, that was something I had a big issue with. Like, you can switch between the old and the new style, but the new style is just the old style, but it doesn't look so crappy. It sounds like this is a much better way of doing that.
One thing I really liked about it was when you are in the 8-bit and it's the square aspect ratio, you can have art on the sides.
Yeah.
And the art changes for every single environment that you're in.
I didn't notice that. Yeah, I missed that. Yeah, I played most of it in the HD and sort of switched to the retro style just to sort of get, you know, just sort of see it. We had Gabrielle Castagna, a specialist at the site, doing video for us, and so she was sort of capturing over my shoulder, and so we got like the transition from the HD to the retro. But yeah, I mean, I definitely would play most of my time in the HD because it looks so much like the cartoon. So that hits my nostalgia much more than the retro, although the retro does look more like a game you would have played in the 90s.
It feels terrible in like the best way. Like it feels like the most dated NES like crap. Platformer, like the obstacles is like a snake that like shoots at you and you like can't jump over it because it's so hard to move your stupid baby body. Like it's so hard and it feels so terrible to play, and I love it.
Yeah, it really is like a throwback to like that very stiff kind of 90s platformer.
Yeah, it's like DuckTales.
Yes, they cited that as an inspiration for it. I was talking to one of the developers who I'm forgetting his name right now, but he's like the lead developer on the game, and he said that the Disney Afternoon Collection was a big inspiration for how the game looks and feels, and I can definitely see that. Or Hollow Knight, if you want a more sort of modern equivalent.
That game also, listeners.
Yeah, that game also sort of has that. I don't know, Hollow Knight. I think that was part of the reason I didn't click with it, was because it has a very sort of stiff feel to it in the way that those older platformers did.
I'm trying to remember what the original Rugrats game was like, because there was a Rugrats platformer for, I think, the PlayStation 1. It's probably for other systems as well, but I think I had it on the PlayStation 1. It was something about Reptar, possibly Reptar's Revenge. I might be getting that mixed up with Spyro. I know that was a rip.
I 100%ed that game multiple times. If you 100% that game, at the end, you play a level as Reptar stomping through the city, and then he puts on a top hat and gets a cane and does like a...
Yes, oh, I must have done that. I remember that. I do remember playing as Reptar, yeah. Okay, I don't want to spend the whole time talking about this Rugrats game that you both think is kind of terrible. Eric, I know a lot of the things that you've seen, you just can't talk about that they're embargoed for a long, long time. GDC, because it's not fan-facing, tends to have much longer embargoes, and sometimes they don't have any expiration on the embargo. They're just going to show you a cool thing and say, you can't talk about this ever. What were some cool things that you can talk about? Is there anything?
Yeah, I went to the Mix, which is like the Media Indie Exchange. It's like a separate event that you'll see pop up around Summer Games Fest and other stuff. And all that stuff that I played, I can talk about. I think the coolest thing I got to play there was Hyper Light Breaker.
Okay.
The sequel to Hyper Light Drifter, but not really. Because if you played Hyper Light Drifter, that is a like a isometric, mostly linear, like action-y Hades kind of thing. It's cool. It's a really good twitchy action game. This one is a pivot. It is a 3D roguelike. So much like the original Risk of Rain was like a 2D game, and then Risk of Rain 2 was a 3D roguelike. Honestly, this is just Risk of Rain 2, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, that's a good game.
No, yeah, I think that's a great game.
It's three-player co-op. It is character-based, and then you have some customization with, like, so they each character has like their own like gear and stats, but then you have like essentially badges that you can like mix and match to adjust their stats that you'll collect and as your upgrades. So then you go into kind of a procedurally generated open world, and then there's three mini bosses. You go around the world collecting upgrades, beating those three mini bosses, that unlocks the boss. You beat the boss, you go to the next stage. It sounds like I've just described Risk of Rain 2, but it's called Hyper Light Breaker. And it's cool. It feels really tight. Hyper Light Drifter does too. So like there is some carryover there, but it is very interesting that they just went like, oh, we have this like beloved hit indie, you know, isometric game. let's make Risk of Rain 2.
Because that worked last
time. Yeah. Right.
How does it work on with the characters? Because I know GDC is all about like discovering the secrets behind games and how they all come together and how exactly games are miracles. And I'm speaking here with no real knowledge on how games work. But I always feel like when I play a roguelite that has multiple characters, so much effort goes into making each character different that it feels like more time should have been spent on making the game good. Most of the my favorite roguelites, all of them really, tend to have very strong... I mean, we just mentioned Hades. I know you love Returnal. Mm-hmm. There's one character who kind of carries that, and the game is built around them. And I think a lot of the indie arcade games that have like 17 different characters to choose from, I always think you should just pick your best one and gone from there.
Yeah, it's interesting because those almost feel like two different genres of roguelike.
Yeah,
because there's a lot of great, like Vampire Survivors has a billion characters, and Binding of Isaac. Like, it's kind of, it's less about like a character and more about like your starting loadout.
Yes.
So you're choosing like which loadout you want to start with, basically. So yeah, that's what they're going for. I thought it was cool. I also played this game called Rugrats at the mix.
Nice.
So like you were saying, like I had so many meetings and so many previews and demos and meeting with publishers, and I'm not allowed to talk about any of it, which is so strange for us because we cover stuff like PAX and Comic-Con and Summer Games Fest, and everybody wants us to talk about their games. But at GDC, they don't want us to talk about their games. They just want to they just wanted to say hi to press and like keep this on your radar. But the things I can talk about is the panels and the award shows.
Yeah, the panels are really interesting to me because a lot of panels at the more fan-facing ones, they tend to be like Comic-Con, like conventions. They have the voice actors right there most of the time. They talk about different memes and fan art and how much they love the community. And I think that's really important. I do think it's important to cultivate that in gaming. But the PAX stuff, the GDC stuff, sorry, is really specific. There were a couple that I know you were in that just went way over my head. Some of them are really interesting, but some of them were so hyper technical. What's that like being there, I suppose? Because we got the highlights from you, but you're sat in it for, you know, an hour or more sometimes.
It's like I'm really not supposed to be there. You know? It's like I've snuck into this, like... Well, a lot of them feel like lectures at like a video game school.
Yeah.
It reminded me of, because like I went to VFS, which has a huge game program, and I had a lot of friends in the game program, so I would be in their lectures sometimes, and it felt like that, like listening to how games are made for an audience of other people that make games, and me being like, can you please say something that can be a headline? But it's not, a lot of it is not like that at all. But a lot of those were my favorite ones, just because like it's just so cool to learn about really intricate details of how games are made, and more than that, the thought process of how games are made, how things that are like technical and complicated, how that flows down to the end user experience. Because everything they do is like, but how are people gonna experience
play it? Yeah,
you know. So like, man, I sat in some really cool ones. Like, one was the weapons designer for The Last of Us 2, but more specifically, not like the models of the weapons, the physics of the weapons.
Right.
And most of the talk was about like the arc and parabola and trajectory of arrows when you fire them from the bow. That was like, it was like a half hour of like, how do you make an arrow fly?
Wow.
And it was fascinating. So the secret is, what I learned is, when you fire the bow and arrow on The Last of Us 2, it actually fires three arrows at the exact same time. One of them fires from Ellie's perspective, like the character actually firing the arrow.
Yeah.
One of them fires from the camera's perspective, because your camera's over her shoulder.
It's
floating, right? And then a third one fires from that same camera perspective, but it's only checking collision, if it would hit a rock or a tree branch or something. So it fires three arrows at once from all those different angles, and then the only one you see is the one that actually hits where the target is. Right? Because the because the takeaway was like, if you have a target reticle on the screen, that is where the damage must go. Like in the to your player, they see the target, that's where it has to hit. So they have the arrow come from all these different directions to make sure that if Ellie is behind, is on a corner and realistically wouldn't be able to shoot through that corner, but the camera is off and can see around the corner, that when you fire that arrow, the arrow actually hits the target.
Yeah, that's interesting. That is something that I do, not just in Last of Us, but in a lot of third-person games. You kind of go to the edge of the wall, and you lean, and you're not really leaning around the wall, but you can see around the wall, so you shoot anyway. It's you just kind of think, it's just kind of, yeah, that's magic. That just happens. Like, you don't really think about the thought process and what goes into that.
I would be remiss not to talk about my beloved Midnight Suns.
Yes, because
I had an amazing panel about how the combat was designed for Midnight Suns, and on that same topic, if your hand is unplayable, meaning like you have all hero, they all cost heroic points, and you don't have enough heroic points to play any of your cards, when you redraw, it will not pull the card from the top of your deck. It will give you a playable card every time. And and I was like, no, I wish I didn't know that. But that Midnight Suns panel was so cool because it was talking about how they started from XCOM and created Midnight Suns, but how they learned to do the opposite of XCOM in so many ways. So it's like, in XCOM's combat is predictable actions with unpredictable outcomes, because there's you have your percentage chance, but you know every character has these are the things they can do. So they're fixed.
Whenever they're in control, they're going to do that thing.
Yeah, and then you have an unpredictable outcome, meaning it might miss or know whatever. And then Midnight Suns is the exact opposite. Because you're drawing your actions from a deck, so you have unpredictable actions, but the outcomes are fixed. There's no like percent to hit. Like if you do a thing, that's exactly what happens. And I thought that was so fascinating because they're like, because apparently Marvel came to them and said, "We love XCOM. Will you do Marvel XCOM?"
That is interesting because I feel like some of the Marvel games just haven't really got a lot of promotion. This was definitely one of them. I think there's probably going to be people listening to this who don't have much of an inkling of what it is. And it's strange that this would be something that Marvel would go out and...
Yeah.
Couldn't, really. And then... I know it was advertised at the time. I know it would be on sale. I know it's been in the Games with Gold or the PlayStation Plus version of that. I can't remember what it's called. But yeah, it's always seemed like it's never really got its due, Midnight Suns.
I know.
It's a bummer too, because part of it is release window, right? Because it came out in December. After a lot of sites had put out their like game of the year already. Like I feel like if that game had come out,
the Game Awards as well.
Yeah.
If that game had come out in August, I feel like when nothing else was coming, or like picked a window where there was very little coming out and had time to build steam, I feel like it could have been a bigger hit because it's great. It's just like I didn't pick it up until the beginning of 2023 because of how late in the year it launched, and it's just a bummer because it is one of the best of the Marvel games that I've played. Like it's that and Spider-Man, the Spider-Man series for me, that are sort of a notch above everything else they put out.
Yeah
definitely. It's interesting you're saying, like, going to these panels and about the headlines, because a lot of times when I'm doing interviews, I don't really care about getting a headline. Like, I want one, and I want to be able to make it interesting. But my favorite interviews that I can think that I've done, both at like Gamescom or over the internet or wherever I've been, they haven't necessarily been ones where I've got a one sentence killer. Like obviously when you were in the Baldur's Gate thing and they said, "We're not making any more Baldur's Gate," that was obviously going to be the headline from that immediately.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think it is more interesting to just have the space to dive into the smaller stuff, and GDC is probably the best place for that.
I think it's just so beneficial as someone who writes about games, just to like get a perspective and hear how developers talk about them. I think I think it's just really valuable to because we write about developers as much as we write about games, you know, and it is really useful to be able to write in their language when possible.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like GDC and PAX, you're sort of getting opposite experiences in some ways, because at GDC, you're talking about how you're getting these long panels where you're talking about, you know, very specific things. I feel like The Last of Us might have had like a panel a couple years ago where they just talked about how they did the shattering glass mechanic on like how you can break car windows and like store windows as you walk around Seattle. And like you're talking about with the bow and arrow and how that is just laser focused on that one topic. And PAX East is like, they're giving you like the quickest, dirtiest pitch of what their game is. Like 5 minutes, here's everything you need to know about our game. There's no time for like the little nuances. Like you might ask a follow-up that prompts that, but they are in pitch mode more than they are in, I don't know, explicate mode. They're not like trying to explain like the depths of their game. They're trying to give you the highest level of it.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's probably time to like bounce back to PAX, because it's really fun to talk about things that don't get headlines, but hopefully we have a headline we can put on this video that isn't just, here's how the arrows work. There's three of them. Give us a non-regrets game that you loved from PAX.
Well, I got to see Visions of Mana. When is this coming out? Can I talk about this?
Friday?
Okay, that is the 29th. Visions of Mana is embargoed till the 28th, so we're good. yes, I got to play Visions of Mana, and I got to talk to Oyamada, who's the longtime producer on the series. Just a second, I want to get his first name. Masaru Oyamada. I talked to him about the demo that I played in the series. And so during that, we got to play through two different areas of the game. They put us first in a place called Fallow Step, which is like a sort of wide open field kind of area. And they frustratingly only gave us about 15 minutes there. So like you could have spent like a few hours, I'm sure, exploring everything that was there. And I really just got to scratch the surface of that. But it did give me a sense of how the game is going to play and how exploration is going to work. The game that it actually weirdly reminded me of was Super Mario Odyssey, because as soon as I got out into the field, I looked up on top of like this thatched roof of a house that was near the entrance, and I could see something glowing up there. And I was like, this is like an RPG. I probably can't like jump up and see what's up there. But yeah, you have a double jump, you have an air dash. So you can, like, I, like, jumped up there and found, like, a little collectible. And those are, like, scattered all throughout the world. So it really encourages you to, like, go off the beaten path and, like, use your traversal abilities more than I tend to expect from this sort of RPG.
I think a little bit like myself, you are a novice at the Visions games. I know they've got quite a big following at the site. But I've never played them. I don't think you'd ever played them before we'd gone. How was that as, I guess, an outsider? Because these games tend to be marketed very heavily towards people who are well aware of the series, the aesthetics, what to expect. But obviously, they need somewhere along the line to get new players involved as well.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to tell where in the game this demo was pulled from, so I'm not sure how much it does like introduce you to the characters, but that was something that I was like trying to get my head around, was like who the characters were that I was traveling with, and like which voices go with which characters, because basically all of the voices sounded like they could go with any of the characters. One of the people was like really had a really deep voice, and it took me forever to figure out that it was like the really twinky cat boy that had the really deep voice, which surprised me. So yeah, his name is Morley, and he's a cat boy, and he's got like the deepest voice. And then there's Karina, who is like a Southern Belle, and then you play as Val, I think is the name of the character. So it took me a while to sort of understand the dynamics, but in terms of like gameplay, it's very easy to pick up. It feels instantly intuitive, and like that element was easy to pick up. It's very anime, and so people that like bounce off of that stuff are gonna bounce off this, I would say, because like we're 5 minutes into talking about this and I've said Catboy, so like that gives you a sense of, you know, what to expect from
it. These are the vibes that we're looking for here.
Yeah, but like from a gameplay perspective, really easy to pick up and play, and it has that sort of immediate reward loop because you can, you know, see these collectibles and pick those up, so it gives you something to constantly be doing that feels good. So that was easy, but then like story-wise, as somebody who has not played these games, it was all sort of over my head, which may be a function of it being a demo culled from the middle of the game as much as anything. Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm not 100% sure yet. I'd have to play more to really know.
I want to bounce back to Eric in a second, but you've used the example twice now, so I just want to just get from you, what was the game you played at PAX that was the least like any Mario game? Because both games so far
remember
this Mario game. It's been a little bit like this.
The one that I played that was least like a Mario game is Linkatoo. Which is a circuit building game. So it starts very simple where you have like, basically a start and a finish, and you have to figure out how to build a circuit from
Mario Maker.
Exactly. Yeah, like Mario Maker. It reminded me of, I never played these, but the way people talk about them is I think Zachtronics is the name of the studio that makes them.
Okay.
Where they're just like machine building games, basically. You have to build something that functions, and that was sort of like that. It's like layering on increasingly complicated mechanics, and you have to figure out how to get the electricity from point A to point B. Basically, every day at PAX, I played the most mentally taxing thing last, which is not what you want to do, but that is what... I played this at, like, 5 o'clock. I started the demo at 5 o'clock and was just like, oh my gosh, I can't do this. There was luckily a very nice PR person there who, like, when he could tell I was stuck, came over and basically told me what to do, but at a certain point, I had to tap out because it was just too much for my brain. But if you are well-rested, you've just had your coffee... That would be a really fun game to play. There's nothing like Mario.
Yeah. Well, I commend you for not going the easy route of picking a really dark shooter. And when I was at Gamescom, I did Post-Trauma last. It was last of the last day as well. And there's a puzzle in the game where there's two clocks and they've got red hands and blue hands. And you just have to add up the numbers of the blue hands and the red hands, like 2 o'clock and then 6:30. And you have like, and I was just staring at it for ages and I just couldn't figure it out. And the guy was like, oh, it's just like 6 + 2. And I had to think for a second about what is 6 + 2?
Yeah.
Because you're just so drained after these days.
Yeah.
I feel that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of surprising how drained you feel after that. I guess it's just hopping into so many different things that you have to learn quickly and then do. But yeah, you feel completely mentally drained after that. So Eric, do you see anything fun?
Anything like Mario or perhaps not like Mario?
Yeah.
Well, let me talk about the award ceremonies.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
So there's two award shows. There's the Independent Game Festival Awards and the Game Dev Con Awards, and they do them as one. They do independent games first and then immediately begin Game Dev Con. And so there are a couple of really interesting things about the Independent Game Festival Awards. One is that the award winners, I had heard of almost none of them, in part because most of them are not yet released. So they were things being shown or at GDC, and then they were giving awards to games that aren't out yet, which is cool. But good for discoverability, I guess. So I want to touch on just a couple of those that looked really interesting. First of all, The grand prize, the $30,000 prize, went to Venba.
I knew Venba had won, actually. I didn't realize it was a prize attached. I thought it was just kind of a gimmick award, like some of the other things. So that's a cool award.
Between the GDCAs and this, Venba won quite a few that night.
Played Venba, just for people who maybe don't know it? I have, but have you played
just in like a preview, just as like a sample?
Okay, I played the whole thing. I think we discussed this a little bit when we did the game Erasers. It's not something that I hugely connected to.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of people who really, really did. Just for people who are wondering kind of what Vember is, I guess, is the point of this discoverability. Mm-hmm. Vember actually is it. It came out last year, so you can go and get that now. It's basically a cooking sim, but the point of it is not to cook the dishes. It's as you go through the different foods. There is a Tamil boy who lives in Canada, and he basically grows apart from his culture and heritage. He wants to kind of fit in. His dad gets beaten up at one point for looking foreign. His mom can't get a job because she's got an accent, all these sorts of things. And it's through cooking that he really rediscovers, I guess, his love of his family culture and connects with his mother. So it's a cooking sim that it has a narrative and not just in a kind of we need to win the bake off kind of way, but in a there's a real story to it. So I guess it didn't resonate too well for me, but I'm glad that won. Sorry, Eric, just
to
let people know about why that game won, what it is, why they
should care. So they have an award called the Nuovo Award. It's like the award for innovation.
Yeah.
And that went to Anthology of the Killer, which is actually a series. So there are 9 of the Killer games. These are like itch freeware games. And it is they are 3D adventure horror games with this like extremely sloppy MS Paint art style. They are very like old Flash game vibe. And I haven't played them, but they're all free on itch. The first one's called Voice of the Killer, and then I think there's like 9 of them after that. Yeah, check that out if you like really niche horror stuff. It looks pretty cool. Excellence in Visual Arts went to a game called Phenopolis, which is not yet out.
Never heard of it.
It is a sort of an isometric platformer kind of game. It's a very story focused thing about a kid who is the only person that sees the rise of fascism happening around him.
Okay.
Pretty timely piece. Excellence in Audio is another unreleased game, but it has it's early access. It's called Rhythm Doctor, and it is just rhythm heaven in a hospital.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It looks very charming. The Excellence in Design, this game won a couple of awards. It's called Crypt Master. It comes out May 9th, and it has a demo on Steam. It is a old school dungeon crawler, like a kind of like a Grimrock kind of thing, but it's a typing game. So you're typing in the actions to fight and search and everything. But it has kind of a free. Yeah, go ahead.
I think Meg played that at EGX or WASD or something last year. That typing to fight brings back. I remember Meg telling me a game like that. If she did, then we'll have a preview on the site and I'll send Eric. And if she didn't, then we'll cut this bit from the video, so it won't matter.
I think it's not so much like a typing game in the sense that like it's like a lot of typing games are about how accurate and quickly can you type. This is more of like a solving puzzles by typing.
Yeah,
the right
no,
words.
That sounds like it. Yeah, you have to find the right word. I'm getting closer and closer. I think this was the game.
So that was Excellence in Design. Excellence in Narrative was Mediterranea Inferno, which I know nothing about. Audio Award went to RAM Random Access Mayhem, which is a student game, which I thought was cool. It's a roguelike. And then the coolest award is called the Alt Control GDC, which is all games with bespoke controls, like an input that is not just a keyboard and mouse or a controller. They have to invent something for their
game.
And so this category, they had like 12. It's like a class of all of these video game inventors, and they showed this really cool reel of all their different types of games, where it's like one was like you sit on a toilet and you hold a plunger and you move the plunger back and forth to like ski down a hill. It's all like wild stuff like that. The winner was a game called Chumo.
Okay.
That's Chumo. And what exactly was it? It's like an escape room, like an interactive escape room. It's really hard to explain all these inputs, but it's like, yeah, it's like a virtual interactive escape room. It's called the Exorcist Exams. Okay. I didn't get a chance to do it. I wish I could have. But it looked fascinating. The thing about the Independent Game Awards, every single recipient used their speech, and they had a lot of time compared to the Game Awards. They had a lot of time up there. Every single one of them used their time to call out injustice. It was a incredibly hostile environment in a very like necessary way. So it was either about the state of the game industry and the layoffs, the lack of visibility for these kinds of games, like the way that the platform holders don't do anything to elevate anything but the most high profile AAA biggest budget games. People talking about Gaza, people talking about capitalism, like every single speech was a call out. And it was amazing. The vibes are incredible. And then the pivot from that to the GDC awards, which was just giving a bunch of AAA games more awards, like the vibe shift was palpable. That's when Nintendo would get up on stage to accept their Zelda awards and just be like, we love the players, thank you for this.
Yeah,
goodbye. You know. It was the mood was really interesting. The host of the GDC awards, Alana Pierce, did a great job, tried to keep that hostile energy going. Just to say, like, we're all here to celebrate games that made billions while developers en masse lost their livelihoods. There was a lot of that. The GDC Awards was a lot of stuff you would predict. Hi-Fi Rush won Best Audio. Baldur's Gate 3 won almost everything. Vemba won Best Debut.
Was this where Sven Vinky had his... where he said something about capitalism or injustice of megacorporations or something?
So this is interesting. So we had already gone through the whole Independent Game Foundation Awards or Fest Awards, and every single person got up and said F the man, right?
Yeah.
And then we get to the GDC Awards and it's a lot more sterile, but then Sven gets up to accept one of the narrative awards or something, and he's like, I wasn't supposed to accept this, one of our writers was, but they couldn't be here, so now I'm here, I don't know what to say, everything that I wanted, that I would have said, has already been said. But I've been in this business a long time and I've been fighting publishers for a long time, and it's just so disappointing to see this cycle repeated and to see all these big studios lose their institutional knowledge because they can't keep these people that really know what to do on the staff, and it doesn't have to be this way. And so he just sort of reiterated what other people said and what other people had said more passionately and stronger and in a more succinct and interesting way. But Sven got all the headlines because he made Baldur's Gate.
Right.
You know? So it was, what he said was awesome, but he was just like, everybody else already said this, so I'm going to say it too.
Yeah.
And I know it's not the first time he said that stuff. It's not like Sven finally took a stand. Like, he always talks like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, his speech was sort of the least powerful of all of the speeches. And that was the one everybody was talking about.
I think that's important sometimes. I know we kind of joked before about, like, we don't always care about getting a headline. It was just nice to kind of sit and watch them explain how the arrows work in The Last of Us. But you know, the reason that we want some of the most senior developers or people like Jeff Keighley to speak about these things isn't because we think Jeff Keighley's going to say it in a more interesting way, or because he's more persuasive, or because we think he will actually change things by doing it. It's because he is can mount a greater pressure on things, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's I guess risky is probably what I'm looking for. Risky of people like Sven to speak out on this. And I know he kind of runs young companies, it's not quite the same. But you know, the kid who made this student game, like, I'm sure he did very well, I'm sure his speech was very good, whatever, but he doesn't have much to kind of lose by doing that. And that's not to say he's not brave for doing it or to criticize it. I just mean, I do think when people of a bigger profile speak out, there's something in that, even if they're not as powerful in terms of what they say on a micro level as the rest of the speakers at the conference. I think on a macro level, because they are able to change headlines and create the news story, I think it still is worth doing. And having been to some of the other games shows, not even just at the Game Awards, but like the Gamescom Awards, where it's like most anticipated PC game, Lies of P, it does kind of sometimes feel like, what's the point in any of this? So it's nice that some of GDC's at least has a purpose.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, because you know, it's an indie bubble. Like part of these people's frustrations is that they are like sort of screaming into the void. And you're right, it is at lower risk for them because they're going to continue their little indie lives and work together and scrounge together what they can to make their little indie games. So it does matter when someone like Sven gets up and says it, even though he himself runs an indie studio.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, you're absolutely right. But it was just the award show, you know, like even the Oscars, I thought it had some pretty powerful moments this year. You know, the Zone of Interest director speech for one.
100%, yeah. Glazers was the breakout, I think.
Yeah.
The breakout, like the big stand that was taken.
But award shows as a concept are largely completely useless to us.
Yeah.
Pure vanity, you know. But something like this Independent Games Fest Awards, where they're giving $30,000 to the three dudes that made Venba or whatever, like that does matter. And and giving these people a platform to say, like, this, we love games and we love this industry, and yet everyone with the power to do anything either won't do anything or is actively pushing us out. You know, like that does matter. Like it felt like an award show that was really important. When award shows sort of categorically are not important.
Right.
Yeah, there was a moment, I think it was the Golden Joysticks, where somebody, I think it might actually have been Sven, certainly something from Baldur's Gate, had said something about the layoffs or this general kind of, not crunching as in the way we mean crunching in video games, but crunching, you know, everything being condensed down and people being squeezed out.
Yeah.
And then the camera cut to the Tencent table, it would just that morning done a bunch of layoffs. And so I think there definitely is that moment. You say it's just vanity, but if these people who are essentially taking the glory, sometimes some of the executives who go there, think you didn't really have that much input on how this game works or why people like it, go there in a suit and go like hold up the awards, and then all through the night everyone is going to basically saying you suck.
That, right.
Sometimes it matters just for that reason. Sometimes it's enough to ruin someone's night.
Yeah, right. If I worked for a publisher, that was a very hostile environment. I think I would have been very uncomfortable to be in there, and that's good. That's a good thing.
The last thing I played on the last day of PAX was the Divinity Original Sin board game. And that fell into the category that I mentioned before of something I was way too tired to be learning at the time that I was playing it, because it was like 4 o'clock on Sunday. But that was really cool and seems pretty gigantic based on what I played of it. it comes with a like spiral bound book that's pretty thick, about that thick.
Okay.
And we played in just one very small area of the game. It's like, if you've played Divinity Original Sin 2, it was when we were in a very small part of Fort Joy, which is a big area in the beginning of that game. And it's not like every page of the notebook is its own game, but we spent an hour just in this one page of this book, and there's probably 100 other pages like that to play through. So it was pretty cool to see. That game is very expensive. I think it's on the Larian site for like $250, so you know, wow. It definitely needs to really deliver. But yeah, that was pretty cool, and I didn't get to play enough of it to have really a solid take on it as a whole. But it does seem to do a pretty good job of replicating the like status effects of the games, like Baldur's Gate 3 and Divinity Original Sin 2. Like, our enemies got, you know, status effects. Like, you can get in, like, if you like do water damage in like an area that already has water, it increases the damage, and like you can electrocute people if they're already soaked and they'll do more damage. So it is a pretty solid, from what I played at least, like representation of what those games feel like in video game form and board game form.
Yeah, so, I do like that PAX has a lot more tabletop stuff. I know you've done a lot of Comic-Con stuff and they have it as well. The conventions that I've been to tend to stick very much to a handful of the most popular card games, as opposed to having any of the kind of other stuff. They might have a booth on Magic or for Yu-Gi-Oh!
Yeah. Yeah, Larian had a pretty huge presence there, and most of it was people playing Baldur's Gate 3. But they had a big castle that they had built pretty close to the escalators that lead down into the show floor. They had like a Nautiloid perched on top. They had a Mind Flayer statue, and then they also had all of the... They had Shadowheart, Lazel, Asterion, and Karlach, and a costumed Mind Flayer. They were all in costume that were like taking pictures with people throughout the convention. So even though they don't really have anything new that's coming out, except for the board game, which kickstarted a while ago and is like finally, I think, shipping out to backers, they had a huge presence there that's felt sort of like a victory lap to me, you know, after the year they've had.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's something that they've earned.
Yeah,
just be there with the big big hit of a game and just have some statues and cosplayers. Right. It's nice to have that series, though.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And they were right next to Path of Exile 2, which also had a castle for its booth. So it was like dueling kingdoms across the aisle from each other.
A couple things I wanted to touch on. I went to a Nintendo partner event. Got to play a bunch of stuff there. I got to play... I don't know how to pronounce it. Senzura? Tales of Senzura Zao?
Yes, okay, I'm butchering that. The Tales of, I now know the game you mean, though.
I believe it's Tales of Senzura : Zao. I could be butchering that whole thing. I should have written down a pronunciation. This is a Metroidvania heavily inspired by Ori. I played it with the developer, developed by a studio in Africa, which is pretty cool, and he was very upfront that this was heavily inspired by Ori. What's kind of unique about it is you have these two masks. One mask is blue, and when you wear it, you fire directionally like Samus. Fire blast. And the other mask is red, and then when the red mask is gone, you're melee. And you just tap L1 to swap between the two masks, and so you are sort of fluidly mixing ranged and melee in these two combat forms together. And they each have their own special attack, and they have some little different technical things that they do. But it was really fun. It was really fun in combat to, you know, be constantly switching between these two forms. That was sort of a novel thing. And then it has the, like, depth that Ori has in, like, the background, where it feels like the world is really massive, even though you're just on a 2D plane. That was really cool. I also played Animal Well. I played Animal Well a couple years ago at
PAX. I remember you've been into Animal Well for a while now.
It's great. It's so good. It's like when you look at it, you're like, oh, this looks really unique. You know, nothing really quite. I mean, it's like a pixel art kind of thing, but it has this like neon layered thing to it that it just looks so cool. But it's like, yeah, when you play it, you know, it's something special because it's just like this really hands off, non-tutorial, no dialogue, again, Metroidvania, but it's just so exploration focused more than any other, the most exploration focused Metroidvania. There's no combat or anything. There's enemies that you have to like avoid and stuff, but it's just like every new space you explore is like, okay, what is this place? Where am I supposed to go? And it's just this, you never lose that feeling of where the heck am I supposed to go next? And I know that's definitely going to be a turnoff for some people. They want the hand-holdy directional quest marker experience, and that's fine. This is not that at all, and I think it's very cool. Epic Mickey Rebrushed.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful. Love it. Did you ever play that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Angie, you play Epic Mickey?
No, it's one of my Warren Spector blind spots.
Yeah, Warren Spector's Epic Mickey. I can't talk much about this. I met Warren Spector. He told me that was the Wii's second biggest third-party game. The first Epic Mickey.
I wonder.
No.
Black Eyed Peas experience?
Epic Mickey is so good. Shockingly good. And this new one, they actually added some abilities and stuff. I thought it was just going to be a paint job, but yeah. What else? A cat's journey. Come on, somebody help me out here.
I feel like you're describing Stray.
Nintendo Switch cat game. Little Kitty Big City.
Okay.
Little Kitty Big City.
Still a clueless, sorry.
Well, we can move on. I think it's cute. It's another cat game. And I think that's it for Nintendo. Yep.
Okay. Andrew, you had a Metroid-ish game. I guess they're called Metroidvanias. They're not called Metroid-ish games. They have a specific name. Go ahead.
Yeah, I played three, and I want to talk about each very quickly. The first one I played was called Altered Alma, which is a 2D Metroidvania that is like the first in that genre that I've played that's really going for like a cool cyberpunk aesthetic. It's like takes place in Neo Barcelona, and you are just looking for a spaceship to get off world, basically. And it did the opposite of what Eric praised Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown for doing, which is that it does not bury its double jump. I got like three major skills in the space of the half hour demo. I got a knife that I could throw into objects that lets me teleport to where I throw it. I got the slide and I got the double jump all within a half an hour. And I don't know if that's like a demo thing, if it'll actually be that fast in the game, but if it does, I feel like by the time you finish it, you're going to have like a couple dozen abilities if it keeps that pace up. So that was cool. And the background art was really cool. Just a lot of cool, like cyberpunky detail. There were like these sort of spider-like robots that were hanging in the background and like picking up crates to move them. And there was a huge holographic ballerina that was like dancing in one area. So that had a really good vibe and like very quickly became very fun to play. So Altered Alma, check it out whenever it comes out. It's coming out later this year, I think. The other one I played was Memories Reach, which was like a 3D Metroidvania. That's how the developer described it. It reminded me a little bit of like Myst or Riven or The Witness, where it's like a first person sort of puzzle game. I was in an area that was like circular with multiple like walkways and then elevators in between them, and you were trying to line up these lasers so that they all hit a central point and opened it so that you could get a power up, basically. The only exit is like a Geiger counter starts clicking when you try to walk through it, so you need to get whatever's in the center to get out of there. And this had that as like an overarching big puzzle, but then there were little puzzles that you were solving throughout, and that was an interesting balance. There were like these line circle puzzles where you had to like line up these little hexagons within to make a pattern, and then that would open paths for you. And then once I had solved all that, I realized that the elevator I took to get down was blocking one of the lasers, so I had to figure out how to redo that, basically, to get the lasers connected. I got a radioactivity like protection suit and exited the area, and it was just a very cool demo. I don't feel like there's enough of those like sort of first person, no combat, just puzzles, exploring a cool world kind of games. So that was fun. And then the third Metroidvania I played was called Lucid, which the developer is calling a Celestroidvania. Okay. Yes, because the most like Celeste-y thing I saw about it was that you like there were like rock walls that you could like boost through, and those gave you like a boost of speed when you went through them.
That's quite a big sell for you. I know you're a big Celeste fan.
Yeah, I do. I really like Celeste, and I really like Metroidvanias.
I played this. I remember this.
Yeah. Yeah, you're like a little monk guy, and the developer told me that you're basically a Jedi whose order has been Order 66, basically, and you and your master are like recovering from that, basically, and like gaining power-ups. And so that was cool. I enjoyed what I played of that, and I am eager to play more to see how Celeste-y it gets as it goes on. But those were the three Metroidvanias I played at the show that were all quite good.
The hardest game I played was trying not to get murdered in downtown San Francisco for a week. that city has gone to hell. It is a scary, scary town, I tell you. The San Francisco natives will be like, oh, don't bash San Francisco if you only are there for the convention and you only stay in the worst part of San Francisco. And it's like, I didn't put the convention center there. You know, like, it is like a zombie apocalypse. It is very disconcerting. So, yeah, if you want some real life terror, go spend a week in downtown in the Tenderloin, baby.
Well, on that note, I think that just about wraps up our PAX and GDC coverage. So, big takeaway is don't go to San Francisco. you can read more of our coverage on GDC and PAX over at the website. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Visit us at thegamer.com. That's thegamer, no spaces.